We will finish off the construction of the Mikdash, and then we can resume like the way we regularly learn the Sefer, right? The Navi just spends so much time going into such detail about the Psukim, about the Mikdash, at such length, and it's really something that like is not classic in a Navi shiur, just the physical details, the artistic details, on and on and on. I feel like the two ways to do this, either you could just go pasuk by pasuk and really try to get detailed understanding of the Mikdash, which if you do that, it's going to take a very long time to do properly. Or the way we'll do it, and the way we did it last week, we'll do it this week, is take the perek at a quicker clip, with the two goals. On the one hand, getting a basic sense of what Shlomo's Mikdash looks like, right? You should have like a basic sense of what's going on in the Psukim, even if we don't drill down every detail, as well as coming out with a few key insights for us to really take away that some of the either older or newer Mefarshim want us to have about the construction of Shlomo's Mikdash. So last week, just to recall, so the very, very long Perek Vav was really a continuation. The end of Perek Hey and Perek Vav was the construction of the physical Mikdash itself. And the Navi divided that into two parts. First, we had the stone superstructure of the Mikdash. So the Navi told us how they obtained all the materials, all the stone that they got from the quarries, all the wood that they got from Lebanon, the treaty between Shlomo and Hiram, who is the king of Tzur, right, the island nation off of modern day Lebanon. That was part number one, right? The immense effort it took, the thousands of men who had to be recruited to cut the wood, to ship the wood, to bring the wood, to cut the stone, to shape the stone. Remember, Shlomo was super machmir, right? The Ramban explained that even though the halacha, you only need to cut to avoid using metal for the stones of the Mizbeach, Shlomo took that to an even farther degree. Shlomo understands the Mikdash is supposed to be a place of peace, not a place of bloodshed. He knows that's why his father David was not allowed to build the Mikdash. That's why he, Shlomo, is the one to build it. The Mikdash is all about peace. And he took that to such an extreme degree that he wasn't even going to have metal used for the stones of the Mikdash itself. So remember, every single stone had to be prepared at the quarry, then bubble wrapped and brought over to Yerushalayim as well. So that was the first half of the construction of the Mikdash. Then Shlomo got his dream where HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or he gets a nevuah, which is given to him. He doesn't actually see it from Hashem. A Navi comes to him and reminds Shlomo, let's not get carried away. Let's remember the purpose of this Mikdash. It's all amazing and fantastic and wonderful. But at the end of the day, this is his house for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not interested in being here unless you're keeping the mitzvos. After that interruption, we move to the second half of the structure of the Mikdash, which was the wooden inside. Remember, besides the stone, that there was a separate wooden interior which could have stood on its own. That was then carved with beautiful carvings. It was plated with gold, and we saw the details of the plating. So where we're standing now by the end of Perek Vav, we have the building of the Mikdash itself, what it looked like on the outside and what it looked like on the inside. It took a long time to get through. Perek Zayin, this is actually a lot of this is the Haftorah for Parshas Vayakel, which often we miss because often Vayakel Pekudei is a double parsha, and often Vayakel Pekudei is either Shkalim or Zachor or Parah or HaChodesh. This year it happens to be that as Vayakel and Pekudei are divided up, so this week Kisisa is going to be Shkalim. So next week we actually get the lane, the regular Haftorah for Vayakel. So that's going to be this next week's Haftorah will be this year for this morning. So the parak is going to be divided up again into two. First, we're going to have the construction of Shlomo's palace. So for some reason, we'll have a suggestion why the Navi is going to take a break from the whole Mikdash to talk about Shlomo's palace. And then we'll go back to the Mikdash. And this time, now that the structure is completed, the Navi is going to talk about some of the furnishings, the utensils that are there in the Mikdash. Okay, so that's where we've come from and where we still have to go. So I'll load up the screen share. Again, the source sheet today, again, it's not going to be as detailed with Mar Makomos and Mefarshim as it is usually, because we're really trying to do this in a more sweeping fashion. So let's just remember Pasuk Aleph, first Pasuk of the parak. Whoops, that's not what I was trying to do. Just trying to get rid of that. There we go. Right. So the first pasuk of the parak told us that Shlomo builds his palace, and it takes 13 years. Rashi jumps in and Rashi notes that Shlomo was very rushed. He wanted to build the Mikdash as quickly as possible. He get that done in 7 years. His palace, it's not as urgent, you know. He's more willing to deal with the foreman and the construction delays, which we all know and love. You know, we have those nowadays. They had that back then as well. So Shlomo can put up with construction delays for his palace, not when it comes to the Mikdash, however. Rashi quoted that in the very first pasuk. So we then have the. It's kind of striking. You know, we should notice two things. First of all, it's weird that the Navi interrupts to talk about Shlomo's palace, right? Like, I would think you'd have the Mikdash and then have the palace, especially because we'll see later the Navi is going to make clear in Perek Tes that Shlomo did not build these simultaneously. It's clear he spent 7 years focused on the Mikdash, and only afterwards did he build his house. So it's just interesting that for some reason the Navi folds the two of them in together. It's a little bit awkward. The second thing we should notice, just even besides seeing any of the psukim inside, is the difference in how long the Navi takes to describe the two buildings. The Mikdash, the Navi spent, we already spent a parak and a half on the Mikdash, and we're going to spend another 40 psukim. This is a long parak. So we're going to spend like 80, 90 psukim on the Mikdash. We spend 10 on Shlomo's palace. Right? That's very telling. Right away, we can tell that as impressive as Shlomo's palace is, it literally pales in comparison with the Mikdash. Shlomo is investing much more resources in the Mikdash than he is in his own palace. Again, his palace being very impressive, but it's got nothing on the Mikdash. The gold, remember that we saw, the Mikdash was plated with gold, floors, ceiling, walls. We talked about the wooden carvings that were all over. None of that is really at least flagged. None of that is paid attention to in the discussion of Shlomo's palace. Now, that said, it is interesting why the Navi feels it needs to tell us about the palace at all. You know, it doesn't tell us any of the details of David's palace. Back in Sefer Shmuel, we were told that David built a wooden palace. It's impressive. He has cedar wood from Lebanon to build a palace. That was the first interaction between Hiram and the Jews, was David's palace. But he didn't have any details. So, like, you know, on the one hand, you're giving me some details. You're giving me these 10 psukim, so it's clearly important. On the other hand, it's not important enough to go into any detail at length like you do with the Mikdash. Right? It's a little bit odd. So I think we'll try to highlight maybe this idea I saw from Rabbi Yitzhak Levi from the Gush, which I think really captures the message the Navi wants us to actually take away from the construction of Shlomo's palace. Shlomo's palace seems to have had three rooms. The first room is this very large room. It's 100 by 50 amos, and it's called the Beis Ya'ar HaLevanon. Why was it called the Beis Ya'ar HaLevanon? Because it has, I tried to close WhatsApp, go away. Because it has, I did close WhatsApp. That's, oh, whatever. Anyway, the Ya'ar HaLevanon, it's made out of like many, many, many tall trunks. The Targum says it was like a summer palace. It could be there was a very big breeze. It could be it was designed to look like a forest. Unclear exactly what, but it's clearly there's a very large and impressive room, 100 by 50 amos, made out of cedar wood, right? Beams and beams of cedar. So it may even look like cedar trees. Okay, cool. There's light, there are windows, Pasuk Gimel, Pasuk Daled. Fantastic. The second room the Navi tells us about is an ulam. There's a hallway. There's a hallway which is on the outside. It's 50 amos. So this is smaller than the big room. But you have the okay. Just one second. Why can't I? It's going to drive me nuts. Whatever. Okay. Second room. This ulam, right? And then in Pasuk Zion, you have the third room, not the hallway, the Ulam HaKiseh Asher Yishbat Sham, the hall of judgment, the hall of the throne, really the throne room where he is judging. So a couple of very noteworthy things here. Number one, I would not have always thought of the throne room as the judgment room. Megillas Esther is coming up, right? Do we ever have any references to Ahasuerus judging in the throne room? Not really, right? I mean, I don't know what Ahasuerus does. He gets drunk and talks to his advisors about which women to bring into the palace. And what else is Ahasuerus doing in his throne room all day? You know, sitting there while people come in and decides if he wants to let them live or let them die. For Shlomo, it's clear to him his main job, his throne room is the office, right? It's the king's office. And what he's doing is he's judging there. That's what he clearly sees as his main role. In fact, the Malbim thinks that the Sanhedrin sat there as well. Ulu Hamishpa Asa. So the first point is right the connection between the Shlomo's throne and judgment. Rabbi Yitzhak Levi, though, has what I think is a really fantastic point. This explains like why the construction of the palace is here at all. Points out there's a striking parallel between the structure of the Mikdash and the structure of Shlomo's palace. What do we have? Both of them have an outside chamber. The Mikdash had the Ulam, which is the introductory hall before you get to the actual Heichal, before you get to the room that has the menorah, the Shulchan, the Mizbach HaZav. There's the Mikdash is shaped like a kind of a T. So the front part of the T, that was called the Ulam. You have this entry hall. Hey, he points out, you have the same exact thing over here. We have this entry hall, this Ulam Amudim, before you get into the main room. Then you have the main room, the very big room, which has lots of cedar wood. That's true both by the Mikdash, the Heichal, and the largest room in Shlomo's palace over here is this Ya'ar HaLevanon. And then what is on the inside of that? The third room, that's the main room. In the Mikdash, it's the Devir. What is in the Devir? What is in the Kodesh HaKadashim? The Luchos. Right? The Torah, the Mishpat, the law, the source of everything. The Torah isn't it? The whole point of the Mikdash is to have, you know, layer upon layer leading to the point of this, which is to have a place to house the Luchos. What is the palace all about? What is the role of the king? What's Shlomo saying the job of a king is to do? Is to take those Luchos, which we were given at Har Sinai, and to implement them. Right? The king's job, the reason why the king, the palace, and the Mikdash are linked. How many times we emphasize that Shlomo is the one building the Mikdash. And now Shlomo is the one building his palace, and literally it's folded in together with the Mikdash. We have the place where the Luchos are, the Torah Hashem gave us, and the palace right next door, its job is to implement that. So you have a parallel structure leading back not to a base, to a Kodesh HaKadosh and the Luchos in the Aron, rather it leads back to the Kisei Asher Yishpat Sham. Shlomo's job is to implement the law, right? Lahavdil, there's some parallel between the Shechina, which is in the Kodesh HaKadosh, and the Melech, who is in the inside chamber. That's the overall argument he makes. Again, it explains why we need some of the detail, but we don't really care about the particular engineering. All the engineering doesn't matter so much. But we do need to know the basics, and it explains why we need to know the basics right now. Why would we interrupt the construction of the Mikdash? Again, we just described the structure of the Mikdash. Now we're going to have 40 psukim about the utensils and the decorations and some of the impressive things, but immediately we want to stop now to have the palace because the structure of these two buildings are very parallel because the purpose of these two buildings is related. The place to house the luchos and the place to implement the luchos. In fact, the truth is we've been mistranslating when we call this building Shlomo's palace. A palace is a place where I think, as I was taught as a little kid, a king lives. Right. King, the queen, the prince, the princesses, they live in the palace, right? So that's what they do. However, the Navi like casually tosses out to us in Pasuk Ches, Ubeiso Asher Yeshav Sham Chatzer Ha'achares mi Beiso Ulam. So Shlomo, in his house where he would live, was in a different courtyard. Right? And it was a similar construction, but actually, Shlomo's palace is a totally different building. The building we've been describing from Pasuk Beis through Pasuk Zion was not the royal palace. We've been calling it that, but it's not. It's not where Shlomo lives. It's where Shlomo works. Shlomo's office building is the building that's in Pasuk Beis through Pasuk Zion, climaxing and culminating with the Ulam HaKiseh, where he sits on the throne. Where does Shlomo live? He lives in a totally different palace, which is, I mean, it's. You know, different, it's similar, it's nearby, but it's not the same building. These roles are divided. The king, you know, is not the Shekhinah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu dwells in the Mikdash. The king works in the place of the Ulam HaKiseh. He works in the place of Mishpat. He doesn't live there. The Melech is not the same as the Shechina. So this is not actually the palace. It really highlights, you know, and by the way, what details does the Navi give us about Shlomo's palace where he lives? Half a pasuk, right? So it was, he had a porch of similar work. That's it. Doesn't even get its own pasuk, right? It's a half a pasuk about where Shlomo actually lives. Now, there's one troubling piece, you know, one storm cloud on the horizon. It's Shlomo HaMelech, so we can't go too far without something that's more complicated, which is the Navi tells us, you know, who had a twin palace to Shlomo? Ubayas Yasel Abbas Paro, Ashalaka Shlomo Kulam Hazeh. Shlomo builds a very similar palace for the daughter of Paro. Okay. When we introduce the daughter of Paro, so we point out from some of the Mevarshim that the marrying Paro's daughter in and of itself may not be so problematic. The problem is going to be how she's going to behave when she comes into town. But we know it's not going to end well, and so we have this, you know, kind of a dark spot on the horizon. Okay, the Navi says all these palaces, the work palace, the living palace, the Bas Paro palace. So all of them are made of hewn stone, very impressive. Okay, wood, very expensive and grand, etc. These stones did not need to be prepared, at least at the quarry. You know, no bubble wrap for these stones. These stones could be brought to Yerushalayim and prepared over there. Okay. Now that's the end of Shlomo's palace. The next 40 Pesukim, as we said, are going to turn to discuss the decorations or some of the utensils of the Mikdash. Navi tells us that Shlomo recruits a guy called Chiram from Tzor. Now, this is confusing because we've seen Chiram from Tzor. Chiram was the king of Tzor. So apparently Chiram was a popular name in the land of Tzor because the best coppersmith, apparently in the whole neighborhood, lived in Tzor, and his name was also Chiram. So you have Chiram the king, and you have Chiram the coppersmith. Shlomo recruits him. In Divrei Hayyamim, the pasuk is kind of more explicit that Shlomo sends to Chiram and says, "Hey, can you send me your best coppersmith?" Right? It's interesting what exactly his yichus was. The Navi says, "Ben Isha Almanahu mi Mate Naphtali." So his mother was a well-known widow, apparently from the Sheva Naphtali. Naphtali's land is up near in modern day Lebanon, so that's very close to Tzor, so that makes sense. The Aviv Ish Tzori, and his father was a man from Tzor. Now the Mefarshim all discuss basically how to square this with a pasuk in Divrei Hayyamim, and it seems that his father, one of his parents maybe was from Sheva Dan, which also lives in his north. One of his parents may have been from Naphtali, but either way, Dan Mikra points out it's possible that he's a ger. There are many gerim at this time, but he's living in Tzor, which on the border with Eretz Yisrael. Apparently, he had been living in Tzor. You know? So there are Jews who are living in different lands, and Chiram is sending him down to Shlomo. I think Rav Amnon Bazak, in his some of the notes I found from him. So he points out that this fits a theme that Shlomo has throughout the construction of the Mikdash. Remember, Shlomo, obviously the Mikdash is a house for Bnei Yisrael, but Shlomo is aspiration. Shlomo has international aspirations for Yadus. Right? He doesn't want, not that everybody should convert to Judaism, but that everybody should recognize, value, appreciate Judaism, and feel a connection to it. The Beis HaMikdash is supposed to be a house for everybody. Right, based tefillah l'chol ha'amim are supposed to come and recognize the greatness of the one Ribono Shel Olam. So he suggests that as a part of that program, he's like, come on, really? Shlomo couldn't have found one skilled coppersmith out of all living in Israel. He had to recruit from the outside. So he suggests that's going on here once again as well. Shlomo is proactively trying to get more international involvement in the construction of this Mikdash. Now, the description of this guy Hiram has some striking parallels. We can't help but think of what we saw a couple of weeks ago in Parshas Truma about the expert craftsman for the construction over here. Navi says for Hiram, he was filled with wisdom and understanding and knowledge. Lasos kol malacha banachoshes. He could do all work with copper. He's going to do lots of copper work or bronze work for Shlomo over here. The parallel is clear to Bezalel ben Reuben Hur Lemati Yehuda, who had chachma, tevuna, and das. Right, we had the master craftsman for the construction of the Mishkan. Now we have the master craftsman for the construction of the Mikdash. Right, similar words are used, being filled with Chachma, Tevuna, and Das. However, we can't help but also notice that as impressive as this guy Hiram is, he doesn't have anything on B'Tselem. You know, it's no offense to anybody to say you're not a B'Tselem. You know, it's like telling an artist he's not a Michelangelo or a Leonardo. But B'Tselem, number one, so he had Ruach Elokim. Right? He had, like, how could you have somebody who has all the talents? It's Ruach Elokim. It's a divine gift for B'Tselem. And in terms of B'Tselem's skill set, so, you know, Hiram is a specialist. Right? Hiram is only involved in the copper. He wasn't there for the stone. He wasn't there for the wood. He wasn't there for the gold in Perek Vav. He's not going to be involved in the gold at the end of Perek Zion because the gold is going to come back. You know, the man has one job. He's amazing at his one job, but he has one job. He's a man of Nechoshes. Bezalel, what was Bezalel talented at? Lasos Bezahav, Bachasef, Banachoshes, Bacharoshes, Evan, Lamalos. Bezalel was an amazing jeweler. Bacharoshes Eitz, he was the wood carver. Lasos Bachol Malacha. You know, we take the Mishkan so for granted, but there were so many different skill sets that were needed in the construction of the Mishkan that required the miraculous Ruach Elokim. One man naturally would not have been able to acquire all of those talents. That's what we have with B'Tselem. So the craftsman here, Hiram, on the one hand, the Navi is saying, look, this is kind of similar to B'Tselem. We have that same master craftsman. On the other hand, you know, we're not in the world of miracles in the same way anymore. We're not in the world of the Midbar where we have this miraculously talented person. We're in the world of Mikdash. Things are becoming more naturalistic, and that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, that's like Sefer Yehoshua here. Like, what happens when we go from the world of the Midbar to the world of Eretz Yisrael? So we have, you know, some similarities and also some important differences. Okay, there are two main jobs that that Hiram is going to have. One is to construct the pillars Yachin uBoaz. May sound familiar from the Mishnayos. And the other one is to build a massive mikvah, the Yam Shel Shlomo. So this again, this is something that if we wanted to, we could really like delve into in intense detail. But and it is kind of amazing, no? I mean, one, two, three. I'm talking about the Yachin uBoaz, these pillars. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight psukim for these pillars. The Machon HaMikdash people, so they have this nice picture over here, so you can get a sense. Here's the Mikdash, right? The front over here is the Ulam. Remember the outer chamber of the Mikdash. So you have these two huge brass pillars in the front. Look, here drawn to scale. Here are the Kohanim, and here are the pillars. Hard to tell. I'm gonna zoom in for a second. Can I zoom in? Yeah, they don't really cheat a little bit. They don't really give you a sense of the intense artistry that's done on the top. But you come into the Mikdash, and the first you can't help but notice these massive, massive metal pillars. They're extremely valuable, as we'll prove in a second. The second thing that Hiram is going to build, the Yam Shel Shlomo, the Sea of Shlomo, is going to be this massive mikvah over here, which is supported by 12 oxen. Those are the two things that Hiram has to build. It requires the ability to work with metal at scale. He's building huge things. And also with incredible detail because of some of the artistry that's going to happen. So scrolling up to where he's going to do this. So it's they're each 18 amos tall, right? The Malbim has a whole gets into the Kabbalistic. It's unclear, but Barshim trying to kind of struggle to explain what the meaning of the pillars were. The modern Barshim suggests it may have referenced the two pillars we find in Sefer Shmos, the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud. I'll be honest, I don't really understand that. I can understand how one of these is a pillar of fire. You know, say, okay, it's in bright Nechoshes, that's fire. How is this guy the pillar of cloud? I don't know. They're exactly the same. If anything, I would have thought that the pillar of smoke, which comes up off the Mizbeach, would be the pillar of cloud. But then yeah, you have two and one. So that shot is out there. I don't really understand. The Kashrim shot is that it was just a very impressive entrance. You come to the Mikdash and just you're overwhelmed by these two massive, massive pillars. The Malbim, though, does go into the Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic meaning of these. And he says, there's just not at least one piece of it that I can understand, much of it I cannot. But he says the fact that these are 18 amos tall, so the Gemara says that there are 18 vertebrae. There are 18 vertebrae that move in the spine. By the way, that's one of the reasons the Gemara gives why we have 18 brachos in Shemona Esrei. is because you're supposed to bow and say Shmoneh Esrei. Right? So the Gemara, one of the Gemara's suggestions is that they established 18 brachos in parallel to the 18 vertebrae in the spine that that move when you bow down. Right? When you bow down, you're supposed to have every bone in your spine protrude. So the Malbim says that this represents the spine, and that gets into some of the Kabbalah where you have the Sefirot, which are coming out of the spine. Okay, now it's beyond my pay grade. We should just know at least that that's one thing that's out there. Beyond that, what is the meaning of these? I don't know. But just to get a sense of the artistry here, so number one, they're huge. Then he has these two huge balls on top of them. Right, each one of these is another 5 amos tall. It's like way bigger than a human being. Then he's hanging chains on top of them, in which he is decorating them with copper pomegranates. So many pomegranates which are being hung. So how does he say? He says 200 rows and other pillars. Right, this is like a vast undertaking. Carvings on each of the pillars themselves. So he's hanging stuff from them. He's carving them. Detail. You take these people are looking up how far they have look up like 30 feet up in the air to see this. You take a binoculars and you see, oh my gosh, like there is crazy detail on there. I have to like squint to see it. But we're not holding anything back. That's the Yachin Ubalas. Now, why are they called Yachin Ubalas? The Navi says they're called Yachin Ubalas. So the Radak gives the classic pshat over here. Yachin, he says, refers to it being established, like a yikon, a base, a bias, the olam. The idea here is that this house should be established forever. And Boaz from Oz, so that he explains, the Radak explains, means the one Boaz, the mighty one has come. Who is the mighty one who's come? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the two pillars of the entranceway, one to symbolize that this the building of Eretz Hashem should stand forever, okay, last for 400 years at least, and then we have the Ba'oz, the second pillar, to say that that Hashem has come in. The Malbim, again going in the more mystical direction, it's interesting. It's rare he does that, but he does it over here. So he explains that Yachin Boaz, he suggests refer to the two ways that Hashem runs the world. One way that Hashem runs the world, the one on the left is Boaz. That's the weaker one. He says, Ba'oz, Hashem runs the world with oz, with strength, meaning the world stays the same. And Hashem operates through Teva, through nature. Everything is stable. Oz, there are laws of nature. That's one way that Hashem runs the world. There's also, he says, Yachin. Yachin means Hashem will found, right? In some sense, Hashem is constantly changing things in the world. The whole idea that, of Nes Nistar, and the world relies on Hashem's constant intervening. So he says those two concepts, which he says some of the philosophers get stuck on because they seem like they contradict each other, the Yachin of Boaz poles right at the entrance to the Mikdash, at the entrance to Hashem's abode on earth. So he says they represent the two ways in which Hashem holds up the world. Okay, just good for us to know. Now, to get a sense of the value of these Yachin Uboaz pillars, so is going kind of sad, but the very end of Sefer Yirmiyahu, which describes the Churban HaBayis, so Yirmiyahu takes six psukim to go back and describe the pillars, the Yachin Uboaz pillars, and a little bit also at the Yamshel Shlomo, and he says what happens to them. So he says they were broken by the Kastim, Nebuchadnezzar's army, and all of the Nechoshes was taken to Babel. This is vastly expensive, right? Now it's so big that there's no way they could have transported the pillars as was to Babel. So even though they took a serious financial hit in breaking them down, it was worth breaking them down just to get all the metal. The metal alone was invaluable. And you look at pasuk after pasuk where Yirmiyahu stops and he describes in detail what the Yachin Uboaz look like and what the Yamshel Shlomo look like, how many pomegranates were on it. He wants you to know this clearly was something that the Jews at the time of the Churban felt the loss of that. From our perspective, it's kind of surprising. No, I would have thought like, what's on my top 10 of things I'm missing at the Churban? Now the Aron is gone, the Mikdash is gone, Yerushalayim has been destroyed. I would not have thought that Yirmiyahu would spend a number of psukim describing in detail the destroyed pillars of the entrance to the Mikdash. So it's obvious from Yirmiyahu's decision to do that the Jews at the time felt this extremely strongly. So it's clear, it gives you like a sense of what an impression those pillars made on the people when they came to the Mikdash. It dominated when they came to the Mikdash, such that their destruction at the end really hits home. It stands out as one of the most painful episodes that Yirmiyahu feels a need to dwell. We never have thought that on our own, but this like helps us get into the sense of what the Yachin HaBoaz look like, why the Navi here is spending so much attention on these two pillars. Okay. Now, the second thing that the Chiyum really builds is the Yam, the sea, right, which becomes called the Yam Shel Shlomo, which also then gets picked up as a classic sefer by the Marshal 200 years ago. So he builds again. I'll scroll up for a second just to see what their picture of it, so we can get an image, right? So you have this massive tub, I guess we'll call it, which contains water. And you see here there are 12 oxen all around. The Radak has a suggestion that some of this is meant to resemble the Merkaba, the heavenly chariot. And then water could come out of the oxen to then be used to fill up these kiors. The Rambam gives the halachic explanation. We know, we had this. Beginning of this parsha, beginning of Parshas Kisisa, right? Whenever a kohen wants to do avoda, so he has to wash his hands and feet. Kiddush yadayim viraglayim. So that is done with the kior, right? So how do you translate kior? I forgot the technical translation of kior, what they have and whatever. So you have a halachic problem with the water of the kior, which is as follows. The water has to be holy, right? It's the whole point. It's kiddush yadayim. Anything which has been sanctified in the mikdash, once nightfall comes, is disqualified. It's called a psul lina. So if you have any karbanos, all karbanos must be offered by nightfall. Alternatively, if they haven't been finished, you could bring them up on the Mizbeah. It's a discussion, Mizbeah, saving things from a psul lina. But the water, so any water in the kior is going to be a huge, huge problem. So the Mishnayos in Sukkah, I think. No, not Sukkah. Either Megillah or Tainus. Okay, that's embarrassing. I should know. Or Yuma. 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 Yeah, Yuma. So the Mishnayos there go through a few different people who did impressive things, which we're happy about. So one of them is a guy who built this. He built a whole fancy machine because the problem they had in the second base of Mikdash is you have the kior. The kior is filled with water. The kior sanctifies the water. It's one of the klei sharis. It's a sanctified vessel. But every single night, all the water in the kior gets disqualified. So they have to dump all the water out of the kior, get new water in the morning. It's a massive, massive pain. So in the second time, the second base of Mikdash, there was a particularly gifted engineer who worked out a pulley system where they were able to lower the kior at night into a pool of water. And then once the water in the kior is touching the water that's out of the kior, so then the psul lina doesn't kick in because then all that water is mixed together. So instead of dumping all the water and filling it from scratch in the time of the second base of Mikdash, they could just use the pulley system, lower down the kior, and then lift it back up in the morning. The reason why they never had to build this in the first base of Mikdash is in the first base of Mikdash they had the incredible Yam Shel Shlomo. So let's look at the Rambam, and the Rambam is going to explain what that was able to accomplish. Says the Rambam, da 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 da, base Hilchos Bias Mikdash Parakei Lachidal Chatesvav, make your nifsal belina kabosha b'yarna. Right, as we said, any water that's in the kior gets disqualified. Come nightfall, anything that's sanctified is disqualified. The water as well. So what did they do in the second Beis HaMikdash? Meshakem oso b'mei mikvah o b'mayan. As we said, they lowered down the kior into a mikvah or a mayan. Ulamachar malanoso b'chol yom ha'boker. And then in the morning, you lift up the kior, or every once in a while, you want to change out the water. You're not going to keep it full all the time. You always got to change out eventually. And so that was the procedure in the second Beis HaMikdash. The Rambam says, "Hayam she'asa Shlomo kamikvah haya." The whole point of Shlomo's massive Yam Shel Shlomo was this had the halachic status of a mikvah. It was stable. It was attached to the ground. It wasn't a separate utensil, and so the water there had the status of mikvah. He says, "You had the Mesha Amashal Mayim Haisoveras Besocho Main Itam." There was a stream of water that ran through the Mikdash, and that stream was, was diverted to fill up the Yam HaShlomo. So it becomes a classic mikvah. You take a pit, you fill it up with water. It's a mikvah. You take this massive brass copper yam, you fill it with water. It's a mikvah. A mikvah cannot get disqualified. Does not. It can have a psulina. So then it was great. They had the water right there. And then they were so then they could just take that water all ready to go and use that water to fill up the kior every day. So just go back to the picture, we could see it was a breeze. Here's your where's the picture? Here's a kior. So in the morning I just wheel the kior over to the Yam HaShlomo. Oop, I fill it up because this is super cool because these oxen have spouts and the water comes right out and it goes into the kior. I close this. Now the Kohanim can wash their hands and feet with it all day long. End of the day, any water left over, I'll just drain it. Very easy to do. And then the next morning, I'll come back and I'll get new water. So this is a very easy system. The only downside of the system is if you have to be able to build this massive metal yam, right? So that they were not able, even the second Beis HaMikdash, they weren't able to do this. All the amazing things they did in the second Beis HaMikdash, they weren't able to build this. They couldn't pull this one off. And so they had to wait until somebody built a pulley system so they could drop the kior itself down into the systems. So that's what this Hiram is doing over here. Again, immense detail. It's huge. It's 10 amos from brim to brim. It's 5 amos tall. So it's taller than a person. Obviously, we point out the math is not exactly exact because if the diameter is 10, so the circumference cannot be exactly 30, right? Nobody knows about pi just like we do. So it's approximate over here. And there are 12 oxen, three in each direction. Okay, a whole discussion of what this symbolizes, said before, possibly the idea of the Merkava. And it's thick, right? I mean, it's a tefach thick, so it's not like a thin metal over here. This is very thick. It's decorated, there are carvings, etc., etc. Lions, cattle, kruvim, that's where the Merkava idea comes from, all over it. Okay. More. It's I don't wanna, as I said, we could like go pasuk by pasuk, but I just want to get, the basic idea what this is accomplishing halachically and just a sense of the scale and the detail involved in pulling this all off. Okay. Almost done. Chiram besides. So those are his two masterpieces, the Yam Shel Shlomo and the Yachanu Boaz. So Chiram, once he's there, he does other things as well. He has to make many other utensils. He makes the pots, he makes the shovels, he makes the bowls, right? All used as regular kalim in the Mikdash. Okay, then Chiram gets sent home. He's done, right? He's done the Nechoshes. So that's all we needed him for. Okay, we go through all the copper he made, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, now just to give a sense of how much Nechoshes there is here, the Navi says Shlomo didn't even weigh it. Right, it was an unweighable amount of nechoshes, and this costs a fortune. We think, oh, gold, silver, and then nechoshes like low down. That much silver, copper back then, mining that stuff, immensely expensive. Okay, now a couple of psukim at the end, Chiram goes home. Now it's back to gold. Right? Chiram doesn't do gold. Chiram does nechoshes, but we have to have some more gold. Why? So Shlomo does something interesting. He makes more menorahs and he makes more shulchans. Right, all these utensils we had in the Mishkan. We have one Shulchan in the Mikdash, we have one menorah in the Mishkan, we have one Mizbah Hazav in the Mishkan. Shlomo decides to make 10 menorahs and 10 Shulchans, which is interesting. The Dat Mikra quotes the Meshech Chachma, who does the mathematical calculation, and he argues that the area of the Heichal was 10 times the area of the Kodesh and the Mikdash. So if you want to maintain the proportions, you're going to have 10 menorahs to cover the same area that one menorah covered in the Mikdash, in the Mishkan. Very, very interesting. Pshat as well here is like we said before by the Mizbeach. Remember last week in the Mizbeach, we saw the Gra argue that Shlomo had to make the Mizbeach bigger because otherwise it's just going to get swallowed up. So such a big room, we want to have more. Okay, we also should note, I haven't found someone who said this, someone must. I find this really interesting that in light of the international element of the Mikdash, right? Well, this is a base field of Chol Ha'amim. Well, if you have 10 menorahs, so each menorah has 7 lights. So math is not my thing so much, but 7 times 10 is 70. You know, 70 lights of the menorah. Could that represent the 70 umos ha'olam? You know, I would wonder. The number 10, the Dat Mikra argues that the number 10 is has represents two things. They really are the same. 10 is a complete number, something that Maharal, for example, is very into. So the idea of completeness being the number 10, he suggests also as a reference to the Aseres HaDibros, which, you know, there are 10 of those, obviously, in the Dvir, in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So a way of reminding us what the whole point of this thing is, you know, like the Nevuah Shlomo got last week, is to be parallel to the Aseres HaDibros. You know, it could be the Aseres HaDibros themselves are there because of the concept of completeness, or the concept of 10. The idea of completeness is something which permeates the Mikdash. To the degree that Shlomo's own name, besides referencing peace, also means complete, right? We have the Mishkan, which was a good original. We have the Mikdash, which is the completed one. So all the numbers, the number 10, the number 70, you take the Lechem Hapanim, there are 12 showbreads on each Shulchan, 12 times 10 is 120. We know from Moshe Rabbeinu, not to get too much into numerology, but 120 is also, it's a representation of a complete number. Okay, so that's happening. It is interesting with all that done that they had 10 shulchans and 10 mizbeachs, but they still kept only one golden mizbeach. The mizbeach hazav, the mizbeach haketores, there we only have one. In light of what we talked about last week, about how the role of the mizbeach hazav is there as the response, the kodesh hakodashim, the mizbeach hazav is the one with the most intimate connection to the Kodesh HaKadashim. Remember, that's the utensil which the Torah waits until the very end of the Mishkan to tell us it's constructed. The Torah tells us it is specifically parallel to the Aron, right? The menorah is on the side, the shulchan's on the side, the Mizbech HaZav is smack dab in the middle, directly facing the Kodesh HaKadashim. The Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, he sprinkles the blood on the Aron, he sprinkles the blood on the Paroches, he sprinkles the blood on the Mizbech HaZav. So those three are one unit. The fact that there we have the closer connection to the one, you know, Melech Malchayim Lachim, we can understand maybe why Shlomo would not want to make more than one Mizbech HaZav. That's the one, you know, with the real connection to the Kodesh HaKadashim, where the number one is paramount. Okay, took here another picture from the Machon HaMikdash, just to get a sense of what the Heichal looks like. It's not perfect, but we see, you know, you have the golden floor, we have 10 menorahs, we have 10 shulchans, we have the massive kruvim, which are on the wall. This big wall here, it was where Chazal called this the Amatraksin. You have the curtain to the Kodesh HaKadashim. It's not totally accurate. This curtain is probably too big. And also, there should be two protrusions coming out because, as we said, the poles of the Aron are pushed forward. So all the Kohanim who are in here should be able to see the poles poking their way through the curtain. So that's not technically accurate. I also don't understand why they have the walls blue over here. We saw last week the walls were all golden. But okay, fine. We'll give them that. Still, this gives a sense of the scale, the grandeur.
They're showing 11 menorot there.
Are they? One, two, three, four, five. Okay, so we got to, I guess they're gonna say that Shlomo made 10. And then we have the original one of Moshe Rabbeinu. And you have 10 shulchans and the one of Moshe Rabbeinu. I guess that's why. I don't know. Gotta ask them right here. And you see, here's the Mizbech HaZav, which is straight in the middle, right? And you see when the Kohen burns the Ketores, you see he's like looking straight towards the toward, especially if you can imagine the two poles of the Aron, which are lined up, right? And the Mizbeach is smack dab between the poles, so he's really, really facing the Shechina when he's there. Okay. Last point to close, the very last pasuk, and then one nice insight from the Dan Mikra on it. So the Navi says, "Vatishlan kol hamalacha asher asa hamalach Shlomo beis Hashem." So, right, the idea of completeness, as we said before, so it's all finished. Shlomo's kadshei David aviv. So Shlomo brings all of the things that David had dedicated, the silver, the gold, the utensils, and he puts them into the treasury. Interesting that Shlomo does not use. David had set aside many, many, many resources for the Mikdash. Shlomo didn't use them. Shlomo seems to have used only his own stuff. Again, Shlomo seems to have been machmir. He understood not only, you know, along the lines before of having no element of warfare in the Mikdash. So just like he didn't only refrain from using metal to build the Mizbeach, he even refrained from using metal to build the stones. So too for the money for the Mikdash. He didn't even use any of David's money. David's money goes into the treasury. That does not go into the Mikdash even, right? So on the one hand, David is being really set aside over here, right? He's not being involved. David was a man of warfare, and we love David, but there just cannot be a place for that. Shlomo felt there cannot be a place for that at all in the Mikdash. At the same time as that's true, the Dat Mikra points out a very nice literary piece, which is that the Navi in the very last pasuk describing the construction of the Mikdash references David, and the Navi in the very first pasuk about the description of the construction of the Mikdash, way back in Parak Hey, when Shlomo first writes his letter to Hiram to get things started. So he also mentioned his father David. Ati Datus David Avi. That's how the Mikdash segment of the Navi here began with David Avi, and it ends with his father David. So we have this dichotomy, right? On the one hand, David is an Ish Damim, he's a man of blood, and Shlomo understands we have to keep that totally apart from the Mikdash, and he's even machmir to do so. At the same time, the recognition that none of this would have ever happened without David, and David gets the credit. The Chazal say that David gets the credit for it. We see David at the beginning, we see David at the end. That's an idea about David we'll come back to next week when we have Shlomo's tefillah. So he's a man without which none of this could happen, even though we have to actually do it without his direct involvement. Okay, so that's the Mikdash. Now, Perek Ches next week is going to be Shlomo's long tefillah, where they're going to dedicate the Mikdash, and there we'll go back to our more normal style, where we'll look in the Psukim, with more detail and attention, and the Mefarshim on the Psukim themselves. So hopefully this was worthwhile. It was just a different way to prepare. I hope you enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to next week. Take care, everybody.
Great, thank
Thank
you.
you. Thank you.